we watch people down through the years, it is astonishing how much energy the average person wastes in defending his own negative attitudes. We are so willing and ready to protect our right to be wrong, and at the same time so slow to advance the cause of our right to be right. Nearly always, life begins and unfolds through a series of negative reactions to circumstances. There's an old saying that we all know is true, that bad news travels more rapidly than good news. We are more responsive to our instinct to criticize than to commend. We are quicker to condemn than we are to praise, and we are more likely to observe the faults in others than to seek out their good points. All these tendencies seem to rise in deep sources within our own natures. We are not even aware of our own critical tendencies in many instances. And when we are reminded of them, we take it for granted that we have a right to them, that we must have the privilege of objection, that we must claim our birthright of individual thinking because of a tendency to analysis, which means simply to take things apart. And by the time we get through taking our friends, neighbors, relatives, and world apart, the collective results in this kind of a disjointed situation in which we now find ourselves. So many people have taken the world apart, and so few have attempted to put it together, that we cannot be surprised if it is not the kind of a world we wish it was. If then this tendency to negative attitude lies at the root of our trouble, is there no way in which we can remedy it? One of the things that perhaps points this up more than anything else is our personal reaction to situations beyond our personal control. There's hardly anyone who does not become indignant, dismayed, astonished, offended when he picks up his daily newspaper. Yet it would be difficult to prove that any of these emotions contribute to the solution of the problems which the paper unfolds. There is no actual indication that indignation is solutional. Now, some can say that it can be solutional to this degree, that it can cause persons to unite, to rise above personal opinions and attitudes, and can create a kind of aggressive action in some direction or other, that it forms a valuable criticism by which things can be changed. For most leadership is sensitive to the indignation of its following. Actually, however, it is not the indignation that causes this reaction which we hope to achieve, because the problem finally settles down to a simple issue: what is right and what is wrong. And the individual attempting to solve this, coming to valid conclusions and clinging to that which is right, develops a strong, natural, defensive and offensive organism. He will support the things he believes. He will attempt to correct the faults that are around him. He will unite his resources with groups or movements which are accomplishing ends which he regards as right. But none of these things are accomplished actually by fretting, by fussing, by becoming angry or disturbed. The disturbance is merely a loss of energy. The solution is achieved by the individual's clearly defining what is necessary and doing it. Now, one of the reasons, I think, why we have a tendency to dissolve in conflicts within ourselves and with others is because conflict is our only outlet. We do not have any clear concept of solution. The individual confronted with a problem does not see how he can solve it. He does not see any pattern through the application of which the problem can be corrected. Therefore, he can only stew. He can fuss. He can fume. He can become disturbed. In this way, letting off steam. But this is only a manifestation of frustration. It does not lead to the answer. The reason why we do not have more answers is because we do let off too much steam without purposeful meaning or viewpoint. And also because in most instances we are untrained to find the answer. There is an answer to every problem. This answer does not lie in excitement. It does not rest in righteous or unrighteous indignation. It lies in skill. It lies in a disciplined method by which certain ills can be corrected. The application of the proper methodology to a problem must ultimately be solutional. But we look around us, we see the problem, and we recognize that we are unfitted to cope with it. Why are we unfitted? Because the sources of our instruction have generally ignored the need for the correction of existing problems. This does not mean that these sources are entirely sterile of constructive ideality. They are not. But like most of our thinking, our educational and cultural perspective jumps over the immediate, passes or bypasses the simple thing that is needed now, and escapes into generalities, dealing with large issues, but failing to meet the challenge of an immediate problem. Thus, we may have a strong training on what would be the theoretical course of our political, cultural, or economic life, but we are not trained to meet the daily emergencies of our own existence. We are not equipped to do so. We are not given the resources necessary to solve our problem. Nearly everyone who is out trying to solve other people's problems has problems of his own, which require immediate attention, but he is not able to cope with them. He is not able to meet them with necessary resource ability. If then, being frustrated, he sees no other clear course of procedure, we find him settled down into the cultivation of negative, fatalistic, and essentially detrimental personal attitudes. He becomes a fusser. He becomes a conscientious objector to everything. He becomes disillusioned, cynical, skeptical. And particularly among the intellectual group, he loses faith in the possibility of solution. We see this around us every day, where the individual is no longer attempting to plan in terms of solution, but is simply allowing himself to live from day to day in a world that is entirely unsatisfactory to him. This also, of course, brings us to one of the most important considerations that we have, namely the relative inability of any individual to change the collective pattern of society around him. A few powerful individuals may have considerable spheres of social influence, but even these spheres are strangely circumscribed. The moment an individual in high position attempts an action contrary to the general opinion of his time, he finds himself almost as limited as the private citizen. What is not supported by the average person cannot be attained by his leaders. And the average person today is not supporting. He is so much more against what he does not like than he is for what he does like, that practically every progressive effort of society runs into argument, discord, and confusion. The individual, then, being forced to live in a world essentially unsatisfactory to him, but a world which he has not the dynamic to change, a world in which perhaps his own attitudes are minority attitudes, and there is not sufficient support from others to make his projects possible. This individual falls back into hopelessness. He falls back into frustration. He gives up and takes various escape mechanisms as the only possible way to adjust to the pressures of living. These defeatisms are evident everywhere today, and we find an increasing tendency to ignore problems, or to regard them as hopeless, or to attempt to adjust to some compromise solution. We have often pointed out that if it is true that the individual must be the victim of collective pressures, then there cannot be any basic integrity in the universe. We are also reminded constantly of an increasing number of persons who do not believe that there is any essential integrity in the universe. They do not believe this because they cannot demonstrate it from their own experience. The philosophy by which we live is derived from our own observation and participation in living problems. If, therefore, we are unable to perceive law and order in the patterns which particularly affect us, we are not likely to acknowledge law and order in larger patterns, more remote. So today there is an increasing intensity of negation. The individual doubts. He no longer holds it to be essentially true that there is a patterned purpose behind life. If this negation continues to develop, we are bound to drift into an almost hopeless skepticism. But man himself finds his own drifting increasingly uncomfortable. He discovers that actually the kind of a universe he lives in is not nearly as important to him as what he thinks about the kind of universe he lives in. It is his own adjustment that must, to a large measure, determine his relationships with life. He learns also, of course, that there is only one essential contribution that he can make as a private citizen, and that is the contribution of a well-ordered conduct of his own. He cannot give to others what he does not have. He cannot demand anything from others with an assurance that he will receive it. But he can bestow of what he is or of what he has according to his own insight and understanding. It therefore becomes important to the average person to enrich his own potential of interpretation and understanding. Unless he can do this, he cannot hope to maintain a creditable place in the life pattern of which he is a part. We must admit, and we know it is true from continually increasing evidence, that all negative attitudes are essentially destructive to the person who holds them and to those around that person. Negative attitudes must be compensated for in terms of unhappiness, sickness, and premature death. There can be no possible way in which a negative attitude or a destructive attitude can essentially and directly contribute to our security. The only way that it can contribute is because we ultimately discover the wrongness of it and are thereby perhaps impelled to search a better attitude. Actually, anything that is wrong in our own emotional and mental life will be interpreted ultimately in terms of misery and sickness. We cannot win with negation. We cannot criticize ourselves into health, but we can criticize ourselves into sickness. We cannot hate ourselves into peace of mind, but we can destroy mind and its peace with hate. Every negative attitude, no matter how much we defend our right to have it, or how justified it seems to be, must end in a negation in our own natures. Thus, the person who is a critic gradually destroys his social bridges. He becomes an outcast, and in loneliness and sorrow watches his life disintegrate. He will insist that his criticisms are valid, that what he says is true, but if it is negative, it does not help. And the individual whose discrimination, whose thoughtfulness continually lead him into negative discovery, or the discovery of error, this individual ultimately becomes habit-ridden with negation and loses the power and the incentives to constructive thought. Nearly all of our psychological trouble today rests with unadjusted persons who have permitted themselves to develop negative mental and emotional habits. And as it is estimated now that in the next generation, at least one out of every five persons born in the United States will at some time be an occupant of a mental hospital, it begins to be a rather serious situation. And most of these persons, and I have worked with hundreds and thousands of them, who are in these hospitals are persons who have permitted bad habits of mind and emotion to come in and control their lives. Many of these persons have excellent explanations for why they are as they are. But such explanations do not help. The only explanation that is of any value to us is the explanation of how we stayed sane. The rest of it is not profitable. These individuals who are mentally and emotionally sick can prove to our satisfaction, perhaps, to their own satisfaction, certainly, that they are misunderstood, neglected, afflicted human beings, born in calamity and misery, and therefore fully entitled to fall to pieces. All this, however, does not solve anything, and the perpetuation of a philosophy of this kind cannot possibly bring any satisfaction, security, or health to anyone. The answer lies in a positive relationship with life. Now, in going back over a good many of these sorrowful characteristic problems, we find that the individual who has come to these melancholy and morbid conclusions actually did not have a particularly difficult life. The individual who breaks under pressure is one of a community of persons, most of whom have had equal pressures with himself. It is not the individual who has gone through the most that falls to pieces. It is the individual with the least resource in himself. It is not the person who has gone through the greatest tragedy who is tragedy-ridden. It is the individual, perhaps, whose only tragedy has been his own selfishness. But the person who has the wrong basic perspective gradually cultivates a philosophy of negation. He rationalizes, develops logical and reasonable sequences to prove to himself that he is a suffering soul. And when his proof is conclusive, he is completely miserable. And this complete misery has about it a nostalgic kind of uniqueness. And we have a competitive attitude in which human beings actually vie with each other as to which one can be the most miserable, gaining a certain distinction from having suffered tremendously. Years ago, we had a group form. In fact, it was created quite a time ago, but became prominent about 20, 25 years ago, a group dedicated to public confession. These members would rise up in meeting and tell all their sins. It was a little confusing and a bit embarrassing, and did lead to a few lawsuits for slander and defamation of character. But the real cause of consternation was, you would think persons would be reticent to get up and admit the most intimate delinquencies. Instead of this, we found that many of these persons got up and proudly confessed delinquencies which they never had. The only problem came be the competitive instinct to be more delinquent than the previous testifier. Each person who got up had to top all who had gone before him, and took a strange morbid pride in confessing faults that he did not possess. This tendency is part of the same pattern that we mentioned before. The idea that we cultivate negation far more enthusiastically than we do virtues. But this problem of competitive testimony of misery makes a certain importance in life. It causes the individual to feel a kind of significance. And it nearly always arises in a life not adequately occupied with other and more constructive activities. The complainer is nearly always a person whose life is not actively dedicated to some practical purpose. This endless complaining, this constant emphasis upon the evils of things, can be defended. Lots of persons have tried to defend it, making quite an heroic exhibition. But all of these individuals, defending or not defending, but clinging to this attitude, are less effective as persons than those with other attitudes. And we must assume in nature that there is a pattern of rewards and punishments which lie within the psychological and biological structure of man. Instead of assuming that he is punished by some arbitrary penalty in the universe, by some god of compensations, we observe that man is constantly rewarded and punished by the chemical consequences of his own conduct. It therefore has to follow that where nature punishes the individual for an attitude, and it would seem to me that loneliness, sickness, despair, sorrow, and frustration must be regarded as some kinds of punishments, that they are the consequences of actions which nature does not wish to see perpetuated. We have to assume that nature rewards obedience with security. That is, a maximum security under existing conditions, and punishes disobedience with insecurity. As our entire generation is lacking in security, as the average individual is insecure, we must assume that what he is doing, how he is thinking, what he is feeling, these things must be wrong, or they could not be punished by a just natural pattern. And each person must ultimately make an accounting to his own biology. He must face the result of his thinking and his feelings upon the cell structure of his own body, upon the circulation of the blood, upon the vital organs of his body, and upon his nervous system. If these are whipped by his actions and attitudes, then these actions and attitudes cannot be correct. Now, underneath all of this, perhaps, lies a deeper problem. Namely, that biology and physiology may not have been originally conceived or devised for the purposes to which man has dedicated his life. The individual has gradually become a highly complicated mental-emotional creature. And nature, apparently, regards complication as a fault. Nature does not reward any form of complication. The natural processes are direct and simple. And while we may not understand them all, when we discover a new phase, we are always amazed at its simplicity. Truth is usually overlooked because of its simplicity. So man was created, apparently, for a rather simple kind of life. Now, this does not mean that it was intended that he should be an agrarian to the end of his days, or that his entire psychology was built for the time when he lived in a hut in the forest. This is not true. But it is essentially true that man was not created to sustain the degree of wear and tear which he imposes upon himself. Man was not created with an equipment to maintain him against world wars, atomic bombs, crime waves, and the ambitions of leaders and the tribulations and antagonisms of nations and states. He was not created for such an intensive, negative way of life. Thus, his very so-called advancement, with its continuous emphasis upon tension, pressure, and stress, this so-called advancement is resulting in a serious biological complaint which arises out of the bodies of those persons who have exceeded their own resources in their efforts to live. Thus, the answer must lie in simplification and the conservation of resources, the integration of life upon patterns less intensive, less destructive than those with which we are daily confronted now. Nature is again telling us that our ways of life are subject to penalty because they are wrong. Now, a great group of persons arises in a culture such as ours, proudly proclaiming the things we do, telling us that these various activities, useful or useless, are indications of progress. That if it was not for this dynamic with which we are constantly rattling ourselves to pieces, we would not be the prominent, progressive, up-and-coming people that we are. But are we prominent, progressive, and up-and-coming? As we look around us, it looks more as though we were down and departing in many things. It looks as though we are constantly more concerned as to whether or not our progress can survive. And we wake up with consternation to discover that somebody else discovered the Sputnik. A very grave shock to our egos. And we begin to question whether our present way of life is protecting and preserving the leadership we thought we had. Because in the long run, a world or a generation or a nation or a race of sick people cannot preserve leadership. We cannot rule the world if our own psychic natures are in a state of constant uproar and disintegration. In our own daily and immediate problems, these same rules hold true. We live in a constant tension. in an intensity almost beyond our conception. We think we're getting used to it. We are firmly convinced that man can adjust to anything. To a degree, man can adjust to anything that is real. Man can adapt himself to all inevitables, because inevitables arise in nature. But man cannot always adjust himself to his own stupidity. This has no valid source in nature, and is merely an expression of his own ignorance. An individual who adjusts himself to ignorance will remain ignorant. To adjust ourselves to wrong leaves us where we were, producing no result that is of any tangible value to anyone. In then thinking about these problems, we turn and seek resources with which to meet them, to try to understand what constitutes a constructive, active, positive, idealistic pattern for life. How are we going to maintain it against so many difficulties? Well, one of the things we have to begin to estimate is the nature of difficulty. Most of the difficulties that we are in are directly due to the person we are. Man makes his own difficulties. He doesn't realize this, and to a degree he appears to be able to escape the implication. He can sit down and prove, almost to the satisfaction of anyone's logic, that he is not the cause of his troubles, that his neighbors are the cause, that his world is the cause, that high taxes are the cause. But actually, the individual is responsible for his own total degree of integration. Actually, taxes are not the cause of his worries or his fears. World conditions are not the causes. The real cause is in the bridge of his own mind. The cause of his trouble is his own attitude toward these problems. If he hates them, he is in trouble. Now, he may say that the thing he hates deserves hate. It may, theoretically, but he cannot afford to hate. It is too dangerous. And nearly always, hatred rises from shallow, inadequate estimation of facts. It is very difficult to understand things and hate them. We may understand them and regret them. We may understand them and hope that we can change them. We may understand them and realize that they arise from a condition of human collective consciousness which is not adequate. We may observe that too much of our living is from the level of childishness rather than from the level of maturity. These things may become obvious to us, and we may find certain individuals particularly and devastatingly ignorant. We may also observe that the untutored and untrained person lacks the capacity for judgment and kindness and thoughtfulness. But out of the entire thoughtfulness which we have used, there comes no longer an attitude of hate, but almost a sense of compassion, a great sympathy, a constructive sorrow for the misfortune of another person whose limitations make it impossible for him to see more correctly than he does. We gain from this a desire to help rather than a desire to condemn. And the moment the instinct to criticize is transmuted into the instinct to help, we are beginning to move onto a positive foundation. Anything that deserves criticism needs help. As long as we approach it on the level of criticism, we will not help. Some people, of course, insist that criticism is a help. But unless it is an essentially constructive approach, unless this criticism is backed by a tremendous depth of understanding and a practical solution to the problem. It merely compounds the dilemma. And to criticize things for which we have no solution cannot be regarded as a good vocational activity. Thus, in the understanding which we develop, our tremendous hatreds and our intensities gradually disappear. And in their places, we have a thoughtful, perhaps sadness, but most of all, a deep realization that behind and through things that appear to be wrong are motions which are essentially right and which will come to their own in due time. In any way that we can help these motions to come through, we are available. But mostly, these constructive motions require a very great degree of personal composure. And when this is lost, the constructive motions are also lost. To then approach this problem, we have to build a philosophy of living, a concept of life that relieves us from the need to condemn. We must find a way of internal adjustment that permits us to recognize error and regret it, but not to be confused by it. Also, we must reach a degree in which every misfortune that approaches us becomes a challenge to greater adequacy on our own part. So-called reverse is not dilemma, it is challenge. It is an opportunity to be bigger than we are in order to meet a problem greater than we have previously known. Every problem is an opportunity for the individual to release solutional power from within himself. Locked within each of us is a potential we know very little about. With every faculty that we now know alert, we are using only a small fraction of our potential life availability. We have at hand countless resources, which we do not even know exist because we have never directly required them to exhibit themselves. We've never called upon them. If then, instead of blocking the mind with negation, we permit a challenge to release its own solution from ourselves, we shall observe that we have much greater solutional power than we have ever known. Once, however, we have admitted a kind of defeatism, the moment we have set ourselves in a crystallized pattern of negation, we lock our lives from the solutional energies within ourselves. Once we have closed our minds to good, or to optimism, or to adjustments, once we have admitted defeat, once we have become cynical and critical, we are no longer concerned with doing anything well. The only thing we are concerned with is how badly someone else is doing it. We have no sense of being able to step into the situation and solve it. We have perhaps no incentive to. If we happen to dislike the individual in trouble, we hope his trouble gets worse. And when everyone's troubles get worse, the whole world becomes more confused, and our probabilities of happiness are further diminished. If then we are confronted, as each of us is today, with a problem almost involving our own sanity, it is very important that we recognize the possibility of further solutional resource within ourselves. We have to realize that man is equipped to meet any natural emergency. He is able to solve the problem of his own survival if he will cooperate with the patterns of energy and consciousness which exist in his own life. It is only when he refuses to cooperate or fails to do so that the problems continue to grow and the solutions to become less and less obvious. When we speak, then, of a positive or active attitude toward life, we do not mean the Pollyanna concept of looking at something that is no good and proclaiming it as beautiful. Such is not the attitude at all. The attitude is one of accepting growth as natural, reasonable, and proper, and also recognizing that the principal instrument of growth is challenge. The individual can never become better unless he needs to become better. And whenever a problem is bigger than we are, it reveals the need within ourselves to increase or enlarge our own resources. A problem, then, is not a dilemma or a disaster until we fail to meet it. And our own poor adjustment to it then sets in motion consequences which we term afflictions. A problem is not an affliction until we have misunderstood it, resented it, rejected it, denied it, or perverted the energies involved in it. Now, we can say that this is hard to accept, because everything in life is constantly presenting us with loss, with disturbance, with perhaps irritation, crisis, responsibility, and worry. All of these things are true. We do have these problems continuously pounding in upon us. But these are not the problems. The problems are our own acceptances, our own rejections, and our own available resources. If we are overly selfish, we create a whole circle of problems. If we are vain, we create a circle of problems. If we are egotistic, another circle of problems. If we are jealous, we get into further trouble. It is our own attitude, primarily, which results in a challenge becoming a tragedy.